Good day, everyone. I'm Mary Texera, and along with my colleagues, Matt Patino, Michael Herman, or German, sorry, I'm making a different ethnicity, Michael. And Jeremy Murray on our panel today for our talk today, Dr. Ma Matthew Guariglia, who will be telling us about the city of New York and its history with policing, especially as it intersects with race last 3 years. Before we get started, however, I would like to acknowledge the land on which we reside here at Cal State San Bernardino. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral. I'm breaking up, so I'll try to get through this quickly. Band of Mission Indians, Yuha Viatam, Serrano. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit, excuse me, and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship. We affirm indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and indigenous peoples. Thank you for putting up with that, because I know I was breaking to my colleague Matt Patino, who will introduce our guest.
All right. Dr. Matthew Guariglia is a scholar of policing, race, and technologies of state power. And in addition to his new book just released, Police and the Empire City: Race and the Origins of Modern Policing in New York, he is also the co-editor of the Essential Kerner Commission report, which he did with Jelani Cobb. He serves as senior policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he works on police technology use and civil liberties. He also holds affiliations at the University of California San Francisco School of Law and the University of Indiana. His bylines have appeared in NBC News, The Washington Post, Slate, Vice, Time Magazine, the Journal of American Ethnic History, and most recently in the peer-reviewed journal Surveillance and Society, where he also serves on the journal's advisory board. Dr. Guariglia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you all so much for having me. I wanted to start by thanking everybody who had a hand in organizing this, especially Jeremy, who I've been corresponding with on and off for the last year or so. This series has really become such an institution with such an esteemed list of speakers. A lot of my personal heroes have spoken. For that reason, it's an honor to give my first live talk since the book was published earlier this month. So I'm going to talk for just a few minutes here, give a kind of lay of the land and talk about a few key findings from the book, and then I will open it up, and I'm hoping for a lively conversation. But on the most basic level, the book Police in the Empire City is a history of the New York City Police Department from its founding in 1945 until the interwar period between the 1920s and 1930s, with an emphasis on how the modern police department ended up looking and acting the way it did, and really still does, as a response to the lived realities of race, ethnicity, immigration, and empire that all affected New York City and other cities of the rest of the United States as well. It really kind of started out as a single city history, but in order to tell the history of policing in New York, I found I kind of had to end up telling the history of policing in the United States and really in the Atlantic world in general. There was never a mythical time in which policing operated outside the realm of explicit consideration of race and ethnicity. In fact, I've chosen to research this time period because when studying the origins and the inventions of many of the tools and tactics of policing, things like community policing, special units, surveillance, deportation as a supposed tool of crime management, all of the kind of tools we know that police use these days, by studying their origins, their inventions, I found that they were all generated at a time when discussing race was not just explicit, but it was essential to the intellectual work of policing. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the key findings of the book, which is throughout the last decades of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century, a group that I call police intellectuals, and this includes beat cops, detectives, commissioners, politicians, social scientists, medical physicians, academics, journalists, basically anybody who publicly thought about crime. All of these people, whether they spoke to each other or not, whether they were in explicit conversation with each other or not, all these people were obsessed with the dilemma of how to police a rapidly diversifying city. How could American-born and English-speaking police force go from controlling a city that went from 80% native English-speaking to less than 40% native English-speaking in just a span of 30 years? In their eyes, immigrant communities, especially those deemed foreign and incompatible with the white and Anglo-Saxon American way of life, represented a terra incognita, unknowable and therefore unmanageable terrain. Police couldn't understand people. They couldn't understand the languages, the customs, the kinship networks, the associations, and partially because of their own exploitation and brutalization of immigrant communities, they couldn't find reliable witnesses to crimes in these neighborhoods either. This problem was compounded by the fact that working class immigrants often lived in dense tangles of tenements that were deemed unnavigable to all but the people who lived there. So police intellectuals believed that these spaces, both constituted of immigrants and working class people that were unknowable to police, and also inhabited spaces that were physically unknowable to police, created spaces and communities where crimes could flourish and people could avoid arrest. And this is what I mean in the book when I talk about the building of carceral capacity. I don't mean, as other scholars have used it, when I talk about, they talk about the physical building of millions of jail cells in America, or the passage of federal crime legislation meant to ensnare millions of people. I mean the very practical bureaucratic tasks and the information required to exert control over millions of people at a time. The state first needed to have intellectual and technological capacity to know, identify, and find people before it could necessarily lock up all these people. And so therefore, mass filing and its more ethereal cousin, mass knowing, is often the more necessary precursor to mass incarceration. And this book is about this process of how the state kind of learned about and managed all these millions of people inside its territories, considering there were huge swaths of people that it didn't think it had the capacity to know and to exert control over. Now, when I gave a talk for this series almost exactly a year ago, and I think that video still exists somewhere in it if you're interested in that talk, I focused on this aspect of the book, that the ultimate solution police landed on to how to deal with all these unknowable people was to lean into surveillance technology, to maintain a massive archive of information on individuals so that a fingerprint, a criminal record, a photograph could be enough to justify an arrest, even when police had no idea how to actually communicate, speak with either witnesses or suspects. The technological capacity of the state to find fingerprints, to use photographs, to use modus operandi and other kind of criminal records was enough to prosecute people, even if the police really could not speak with or get witnesses about individuals. But for this conversation, I want to focus more about the role police played in explicit racial management and race making rather than surveillance, and the relationship between citizenship and belonging and policing in New York and the United States more generally. So we'll start from the beginning, from its origins. The original organized police department in New York, the municipal police, had to navigate an already multiracial and multi-ethnic city from the start, from 1945. And that's because the police department was founded amidst a wave of Irish and German immigration that swung demographics wildly in the city. And was responsible for, in part, a number of mass periods of disorder in the industrializing city that were mostly blamed on Irish Catholic rioters. And so a lot of early historians of policing have pointed to the emergence of municipal police departments in relation to the rise of industrial capitalism, a rise of of property crimes that came along with the accumulation of wealth by industrial capitalism, and also these periods of mass disorder that were mostly attributed to the growing number of immigrant laborers in the city, both German and Irish Catholic. So the building of the police force that was capable of handling multi-ethnic disorder was incredibly central to the emergence of the institution. And the other important role that shaped mid-19th century policing was slave catching. And I mean this very literally, not just in the kind of political sloganeering of all American police came from slave patrols, which to some extent they did, but in a very specific way, which is that after the 1950 Fugitive Slave Act, local police, including in New York City, were under federal legal obligation to return and find self-emancipated individuals to their enslavers. And it wasn't just an obligation. They weren't just legally compelled to do it. After all, there were proposals that kept coming up on the Police Board of Commissioners that tried to ban local police from having a role in slave catching. And every time this proposal came up before the New York Police Board of Commissioners, it was voted down. There was an explicit decision to continue to do the work of slave catching in New York City. And there's also evidence that there were multiple New York City police who were sympathetic to the cause of slavery, who received direct letters from enslavers in the South who knew they had the sympathetic ear of these individual officers, who would send and money, you know, with letters in exchange for dispatching them to scour New York City's very small Black community in pursuit of particular individuals. So we see the emergence of the New York City Police Department, even in a supposedly free state, concerning itself with embedding itself and knowing and surveilling and harassing the very minute Black community of New York, as you know, right after 1850. A lot of scholars have argued, and I echo this in my work, that for the recently arrived or first-generation immigrants struggling with their own racial belonging, race-based chattel slavery became an important way to differentiate oneself and one's freedom and make the claim for racial superiority and worthiness into civil and economic inclusion, like policing. So for this reason, there were a number of conflicts in places like the Brooklyn docks, where Irish workers believed that doing the same job as Black laborers would reflect a degraded racial status. And it was also for this reason that there were many supporters of the institution of slavery among Irish New Yorkers. The most famous example of this, of course, is the draft riots of 1863, in which the Union Army draft and the prospect of abolition caused crowds of working class white rioters in New York to take out their anger on civil institutions, the city's Anglo-Dutch elite, and the city's small Black population. And what's interesting about this specific period of the era are the political cartoons, because the fact is there was a high probability that both the rioters and the police who were trying to restrain the rioters were both Irish Catholics. And yet, if you look at the depictions of these riots in the 19th century, the rioters are often depicted as small and subhuman and kind of, you know, very explicitly ape-like, while the police were always tall and very white, and their crispy blue uniforms had no wrinkles in them. But you know, demographically speaking, these were people were neighbors and kin. So simply put, ethnic police helped to lead their kin into the privileges and social and economic mobility associated with whiteness, that often the first of an ethnicity to join the police were kind of the vanguard of whiteness that helped to whiten their own communities, but also to differentiate themselves from what was seen as people of races lower down on the kind of racial hierarchy by brutalizing them, that they could earn their place in white society by differentiating themselves from Black and Chinese New Yorkers specifically through force. And there obviously existed violence in both white and non-white communities. Police kind of did violence in white immigrant communities as well as in non-white immigrant communities and Black communities. But my book argues that kind of these were two distinct type of violences that happened in context of one another, and that people understood them to mean two different things. In European, immigrant, and other working-class white neighborhoods, police violence was a part of assimilation. It was teaching newly arrived people unofficial and unofficial rules of being an American, that a club on the head or an arrest was in some ways a vote of confidence that they were teaching these people to be Americans. And this is not just my interpretation. Police were very explicit in the ways that violence in white immigrant communities was an inclusive violence. It was a brutal, bloody, and often exploitative way of forcing Americanization onto white European immigrants. In Black and a somewhat lesser extent, non-white immigrant communities, like specifically in Chinatown, police violence was more purely exclusive. It was a way of forcibly denying these communities access to public accommodations, to leisure activities, and to the city itself. And so really, they understood these violence as deployed in different ways in different communities. And in this way, police, I argue, played a really important and interesting role in consolidating whiteness and kind of creating the Black-white binary in a city in which, you know, was deemed incredibly multiracial, in an era where, you know, the difference between an Irish person and a Russian person was racial before it was ethnic. And so police violence, I think, really plays an important role in consolidating whiteness and white privilege around European immigrants and in excluding other neighborhoods. And so with that, I guess I'd love to open it up to conversation and get this conversation started.
Thank you so much, Dr. Guariglia. To kind of, expand a little bit on your remarks, there are two characters in the book, Detective Petrosino and Samuel Battles, that you mentioned, both of whom struck me as really interesting. When you are talking about this, achieving a level of whiteness by being a member of the police department, Petrosino kind of did, but Battles never achieves that. Can you go into that a little bit deeper?
Yeah, absolutely. So Joseph Petrosino was the first Italian detective on the NYPD. He started out as a shoeshine outside of City Hall in the 1880s and becomes recruited to the force because of his utility as an informant. And he becomes essential. You know, police commissioners by 1904 have a direct line to this detective because every time there is a crime that is believed to have been committed by Italians or happens in a Chinese in an Italian neighborhood, they immediately call for Detective Petrosino, and so there's a real necessity that that drives his rise in the ranks in the NYPD, and he eventually gets put in charge of what is called the Italian Squad, which is a centralized squad of Italian detectives that starts with 6 members in 1904 and balloons to over 100 members by 1907 because it is deemed so essential. And most of these Italian detectives had been recruited just in the last 2 or 3 years. So there's a real drive to recruit and promote and organize Italian detectives. And when Joseph Petrosino is eventually assassinated in 1909, while he's on assignment actually in Italy, which is a really kind of interesting story that gets to how kind of global the history of policing in New York is, and also the way that the history of policing local cities like New York is entwined with kind of the rise of federal immigration restrictions and deportation. By the way, so when Petrosino is assassinated in 1909, he comes back to full burial, like a procession down Broadway. There's no television yet, but they film his funeral and they play it in cinemas, not just in New York and around the country, but also across Europe as well. And this is at a time when there are still some people arguing that Italians are not only not white, but are unassimilable in American society. This is at a time when, you know, we are still 10 years away from the Immigration Restrictions Acts of 1921 and 1924, which virtually shuts down immigration from Italy to New York. So even at a time where anti-Italian prejudice is on the rise, he is seen as an absolute hero. And when you compare this to Samuel Battle, who's the first Black officer in the NYPD, the stories are incredibly different and yet happen in the context of one another. For at least a decade, very political members of the Black community were calling for the integration of the New York City Police Department because they think more Black police will result in less police brutality in Black neighborhoods. And so there's this big activist campaign to integrate the NYPD, which requires a lot of very powerful people, a lot of, you know, big Black institutions like the New York Age, the big newspaper, to really push for the appointment of the first Black officer. And the New York Age even says, you know, the Jewish community has Jewish detectives, the Italian community has Italian detectives. We are hoping for, quote, the first Black Lieutenant Petrosino, that they understood the integration of the police force through the lens of this kind of ethnic policing. And yet the NYPD is not really inclined to recruit Black officers the way they were Italian officers, in part because the Black community seems more familiar. It seems less, more easy for them to infiltrate, even if it wasn't, even if, you know, white officers still had a hard time getting access to all Black, you know, institutions like saloons or social clubs in a way that white officers, American-born officers, had difficult times infiltrating all Italian, you know, vice districts. And yet there's no urgency like there was to infiltrate the Black community. So, you know, it really took a lot of activism to desegregate the NYPD from the Black white standpoint than it did from, you know, an Anglo and Italian or an Anglo and German standpoint. And yet when Samuel Battle takes his position as the first Black NYPD officer, he kind of articulates that he feels like a translator in a way. He says, you know, that they keep putting him in majority Black neighborhoods where a majority of the police force patrolling that precinct are white. And he often says, you know, it felt like my colleagues needed me more than I needed them because they were all white and we were in an all Black neighborhood. So, you know, they were incredibly different stories. And yet, you know, I think to simply see the story of Samuel Battle as a civil rights victory, as many people have in the past, is to ignore its context in this era of kind of ethnic policing and immigrant policing.
So this question comes from Dr. Texera, and I think folds in a little bit of where you were going. She would like you to expand on race of officers and misconduct. And you made what you just answered, made a very clear distinction between race and ethnicity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a moment in the late 19th century when Theodore Roosevelt, who's the police commissioner of New York between 1895 and 1897, has a real understanding of race and meritocracy, right? He writes this incredible document called the Ethnography of Policing, in which he literally ranks officers by race as to how good of a police different race and ethnicities make. And so it says at the top are American-born, underneath that are German and Irish, because they're good at policing. Below that are you know, Jews and Italians, because they supposedly are a newer stock of immigrants. And below that, for some reason, he puts Greeks at the very bottom. But he says that all of these races have the ability to become better at police the more and the faster they Americanize. And so there's this idea that the gold standard for police are American-born officers. And yet, you know, and part of this is he creates the new civil service exam. So to join the New York City Police Department, you have to take a written exam, and they mold this exam so that it favors American-born officers, it favors native English speakers. And so you see kind of the demographics begin to change and to favor American-born officers. But of course, by 1901 or 1902, this creates an NYPD incapable of handling immigrant neighborhoods because so many of the officers are now prioritized for being native-born Americans and native English speakers. And so the NYPD has to keep kind of shifting its idea of what good policing looks like, where they want people who, you know, the Irish are good at policing because they can supposedly fight. They're better at with violence and brutalization. And then the primary the prioritization for recruiting officers is American born because they're considered more professional and less predisposed to corruption and brutality. And then suddenly they need officers who can speak Russian and Yiddish and Italian and Chinese. So they shift again. And so really the NYPD has to, at an institutional level, continue to reevaluate its priorities and recruit officers by those priorities. And so we see the role that immigration and race plays at shaping the modern police department because it so explicitly needs to consider these things.
Mike?
First, congratulations, Matthew, on a really great research that you've done here. And it was interesting reading it, how much of the themes and the drivers and the theories behind policing, even 200 years ago, are still prevalent. And, you know, one of those, one of the things I'd be interested to hearing you talk about is Theodore Roosevelt's reign as police commissioner, and the way the progressive era in many ways was seen as a professionalizing influence on the force, but also, among those technocratic sort of theories were a lot of race science that was popular at the time and kind of cemented these as legitimate ways of dividing society and dividing the police force.
Yeah, I mean, Theodore Roosevelt is a fascinating character because he, like many of these figures, kind of rotates through military, through U.S. empire, through U.S. foreign policy, back to policing, back to civil society and government. And he really kind of embodies this idea of trying to professionalize the police force, which he thinks introduces a lot of reform. So, you know, things like police drunkenness, he really tries to crack down on, where, you know, he was often known to wander the streets at night to try to find police officers who were drunk or asleep on the job and kind of frighten them and reprimand them. So there was a lot of, you know, he really tried to crack down on brutality and corruption, on bribery, things like this. But with it came trying to look for societal ways to solve crime. You know, it wasn't just that crime was something that happened on the street. It was that crime was something that happened at a statistical level in society, and that there were these, you know, these new types of understanding society in the form of sociology, in the form of criminology, in the form of eugenics, that could teach us at a foundational level of society where crime was coming from, and we could fix them at a policy level, not just at a policing and street level. And so things like, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's good friend Henry Cabot Lodge was one of the earliest proponents of shutting down all immigration to the United States because of what, you know, he saw as a solution to the rise of immigrant crime in New York. That, you know, if we can't solve this crime at a neighborhood or street level, let's just close the borders. This is the rise of deportation as a form of crime control, where, you know, after the Immigration Restriction Act of 1903, which says that people who committed crime overseas should not be allowed to immigrate to the United States, suddenly there is a vested interest in people in New York to find out what are in the criminal files in Italy or in France or in Greece or Russia. And so, you know, like I was talking about with Lieutenant Petrosino, they send officers to Europe with names of troublemakers in New York to see if there were any criminal files they could find in these home countries so they could begin immigration deportation procedures. And similar with eugenics, this is the rise in many places of beginning to sterilize people who were seen as quote unquote career criminals, or seen as people who were, you know, had health problems or mental disabilities. So thinking about a more foundational societal level of knowledge, academic knowledge, medical knowledge, that rode into policing with progressives like Theodore Roosevelt, became the start of some incredibly nefarious trends that we clearly still live with today. I mean, the cooperation between ICE or Customs and Border Patrol with local police departments, the longstanding kind of medicalization of crime, are all problems that we still kind of live with. To the extent that, you know, we have predictive policing programs in America that consider people's their upbringings, their socioeconomic status, their grades in school, even, and deem people potential criminals long before they even consider breaking the law because of their upbringing. And these are kind of all afterlives of this moment of police professionalization and standardization, and the capital P progressive politics, which really kind of brings statistics and statistical knowledge and academic and medical knowledge into the police department.
And I would add to the contemporary repetitions, the NYPD Muslim mapping program, which was, of course, was controversial about 10 years ago, where it turned out they were using the same sort of crass assessments of a population of people as a particular kind of crime threat. And of course, the FBI also has a nationwide racial mapping program that makes those same sort of assumptions, and how much of that sort of comes from the same race science theories that while debunked, continue to influence policy and immigration policy in particular.
Yeah, and you know, it's so funny that even pre, you know, the Roosevelt period, you know, the work of people like Cesare Lombroso, who's a criminal anthropologist and medical doctor in Italy, kind of was looking for the correlation between physical anatomical attributes and criminality. And so he would go to prison, study the faces of 200 prisoners, look for whether their faces had common attributes, and say, aha, you know, a protruding brow is the sign of a criminal because a majority of these people in prison have protruding brows. And by the turn of the century in the United States, this is kind of it's kind of debunked. People have kind of moved on from that. You know, they derogatorily refer to these people as crime doctors. And yet I feel like we still talk about like somebody who looked like a criminal, or we still talk about the idea of career criminals, people who were, Lombroso had a theory of born criminals, that some people were just born evil and there's nothing you could do about it. And even though those theories were kind of debunked, they have so kind of seeped into the way we talk about crime and criminality that there's still quite a lot of impact of that kind of medicalization of crime from the 19th century in our in the work criminal justice folks do today. And in fact, you know, every few months you see some university or some company has said that, you know, we've developed a facial recognition algorithm by training it on mugshots, where we can have you scan a face and we'll tell you how likely they are to be a criminal. So these things are still very much with us and are, you know, are enlivened by the same biases that have always been, which is, of course, if police think that a certain type of person is a criminal, they're bound to arrest more of those people. And if you train an algorithm on mugshots, then that algorithm is just going to legitimize and give kind of scientific credence to what is already racially biased policing.
And you know, one other thing that I wanted you to discuss is the NYPD's use of propaganda, how it uses information to tell a story that may not be 100% accurate to present a version of what society should be like.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating thing, and I mean, continues to be, you know, just look at most police departments' use of social media, especially how police unions use social media, where they will, you know, send out a tweet about how a scenario unfolded minutes after it happened, only for it to get millions and millions of views and then be debunked a few hours later. And, you know, I wrote a piece on this for NBC News about how in some ways police have a monopoly, not just a monopoly on legitimate violence, but a monopoly on legitimate storytellers, that often, you know, the police side of things is the official side of the story, and what they say kind of goes. And they have the power to reinforce this by silencing people, and often because the people who are on the other side of that story, the people who have stories about being brutalized or exploited by police, whose stories, the version of their version of events don't get heard, are often people who are the most marginalized in society, or often in the story of this book, people who don't speak English, who don't really have full access to the resources they could to like push back against policing and police narratives. So a few stories in particular come to mind from the book is, you know, I went through a lot of criminal court transcripts from the era, especially where immigrants were concerned. And there were a number of stories that I found in which police testify to immigrants having confessed in English to having committed a crime, only to learn that the immigrant in question, the defendant, didn't have the vocabulary to voice that confession. And granted, there's some wiggle room here, right? Because there's a clear understanding that that immigrants had the ability to lean into their foreignness to avoid police detection. So that's kind of something to take with a grain of salt. There's another story of a woman named Dora who, you know, is really quite haunting to me in the sense that she is stopped on the street when a police officer smiles at her and she smiles back, and he stops her and asks, "Why did you smile?" And she says something like, I don't know, because you smiled first," and then immediately arrests her under suspicion of soliciting prostitution. And she goes to the court where the court does not listen to her. She's immediately convicted by a judge on the night court and has to bring in her medical doctor to try to overturn this very speedy conviction, because the medical doctor can testify that she could not possibly have been soliciting prostitution because she is currently in a medical crisis that would prevent her from having any type of sexual intercourse. And so, she was an immigrant woman, and there's such a prevalence of disbelieving or not listening to women, especially immigrant women, especially Black women, and just taking the police's side of events, whether that be in the newspaper or in the judges' chambers. And the last story is the riot of 1900, which is a really prevalently written about story. Cheryl Hicks, the great historian, has written about this in detail as well, in which for multiple days, both white New Yorkers and police kind of rioted in the Black neighborhood of San Juan Hill and the Tenderloin in retribution for a Black man stabbing to death a plainclothes police officer who was harassing his wife. And after the fact, most of the arrests were of Black people in the neighborhood who were either just walking home or trying to defend themselves from the white mob, even though a majority of the assailants and a majority of those who were gravely injured were Black, but all the arrests were also of Black people. And the newspapers reported it a specific way. The police department responded as if it was mostly Black troublemakers who were causing the problems. And so a group of community leaders got together and created a pamphlet called The Story of the Riot, in which they got a lawyer to witness signed affidavits from dozens and dozens of Black New Yorkers about what their side of the story looked like. And they sent it to the governor, and they sent it to newspapers. And there was this really a way of building, as Kelly Little Hernandez calls it, a rebel archive, an archive that countered the police's version of events, because it was so hard for them to get that story out otherwise, because all the legitimate means of disseminating information and stories about these moments of racial and ethnic violence were denied to immigrant and Black New Yorkers.
New York City, new NYPD serves as kind of a microcosm.
Matt, I'm wondering, I have to talk really quickly because my internet is going.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit, even though it refers to LA, the relationship between the show Dragnet, Jack Webb, LAPD, and its implications for policing in general in the United States.
I can't actually say I'm familiar with Dragnet.
Oh, I thought you talked about it. I thought you talked about it in the in the podcast. No, or maybe it was the host who brought it up.
Maybe, yeah.
Sorry,
it's okay.
Sorry, yeah, it's okay. It's all right. We've referenced it several times during the series, but never mind. Sorry.
It was formative for me coming up wanting to be an FBI agent.
Me too. Me too. That's why.
Is it about the FBI?
No, it's LAPD. But it's LAPD detectives who were, you know, plain clothes, suit wearing, just the facts, ma'am. It's literally, I think, the line that they made famous.
Yeah, television show. And they had to get permission from the chief before they aired they actually aired the show. So I think we can, I don't know, just infer a lot of stuff from that. I don't know.
I will say one thing about, you know, police TV shows, which are obviously so omnipresent, is there's a trope that I'm fascinated in detective shows where, you know, there are shows I've seen in the 1870s and 1910 and 1940 and 1970 up to the present where they're like, you know, this is a show about detectives who do things differently because they use science. You know, which is such a trope in The Alienist or in Mindhunter or whatever, you know, show you want to do that. Like, you know, we're not your usual club swinging police. We're the Sherlock Holmes style of police, which uses science and smarts to solve crimes. And that's such a trope of the like late 19th century and into the early 20th century, and really becomes one of the foundational justifications for the founding of the FBI, that J. Edgar Hoover really wanted to perpetuate this idea that detectives in the FBI, that agents were not, you know, your wool clad blue uniformed pugilists, that they were scientists. And that all these police departments kind of developed scientist envy in a way. That really kind of started a century-long campaign to build a reputation of police for expertise, to the point that now you have police who can testify in the stand as expert witnesses about the effects of, say, fentanyl on a person when you're across the room from it, that medical doctors can contradict, and yet people still take the side of police because they've kind of cultivated this reputation of expertise that comes with a century-long process of building this reputation as police as scientists and experts and part social workers and part chemists and part lawyers.
So I was actually right on the same road that Mary was going, but instead of Dragnet, I was going to point to Law and Order, which takes place in New York. You kind of, and what I got from the book was, you kind of encountered NYPD's revising of their own history and extending their propaganda. I don't think it's any mistake that Petrosino Square is in Little Italy and Battle Park is in Harlem. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, come the late 20th century, the NYPD's history becomes a valuable tool in astroturfing, in artificially manufacturing good community relations. That Joseph Petrosino Square comes up in the 1980s, which is right in the middle of kind of the urban crisis and the real crackdown on quality of life policing and broken windows policing. the rise of the war on drugs and kind of all of these different trends of quality of life policing and the bad reputations that happened between the NYPD and specifically Black communities, in which now they could manufacture in Joseph Petrosino Square a history in which the NYPD has always been entwined with the community. That even though that so-called community policing is kind of an invention of the late 1960s, early 1970s, Joseph Petrosino is kind of called in the late 1980s a pioneer of community policing, retroactively applying that term to him as if community policing is both simultaneously brand new and innovative, but also it is something the NYPD has been doing all along. And then in 2011, the kind of embattled NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly renames the intersection of Harlem after Samuel Battle. And this is at the height of the stop and frisk crisis. At the highest numbers were happening with the NYPD stopping and frisking young Black men in the city. And suddenly here's an intersection about, you know, the triumphant first Black NYPD officer in which he is the victim of racism. That he is brave and he withstood bullying and racism both from his peers on the NYPD on the force and also from white people on the street who wouldn't take him seriously, who harassed him. And so suddenly the narrative is the real victims of police racism are not Black citizens, they are other Black police. And it kind of shifts the narrative in which, like, you know, the NYPD is saying to Black residents in Harlem, like, you know, in some ways we're on the same side, which is just kind of a really interesting kind of narrative and historical sleight of hand. They're trying to change the story. And so, the NYPD's history is really full of these moments that become politically useful that they can dredge up. And before the NYPD Museum was destroyed by Hurricane Sandy, it was a fascinating snapshot of which moments in the NYPD's history is deemed politically useful for them.
Yeah, and I think that we see some of that narrative played out in LAPD and in other large cities. I think we're seeing that happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Matt, one of the questions I have, or one of the fascinating things I found in your book was how you talk about the way bias is different, targeting different populations. There's a lot of anti-immigrant bias that drives a lot of it in the sort of the ethnic casting within what were arguably white people, contrasted with the anti-Black racism that existed. But particularly during this time when, you know, there's this heated rhetoric with China and the increasing targeting of Asian Americans with hate crimes post-COVID, how the anti-Chinese bias within police and how the police approached the Chinatown community as a very different from how it policed the Italian American and Black American communities.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, the Chinese community is really occupies a really interesting in-between place where they are not the kind of assimilable white European immigrants, even those from Southern and Eastern Europe, but they're also not as unassimilable as African Americans, right? Like, even as police are like racking their heads about how unknowable Chinatown is, and there's a lot of like Orientalist rhetoric about you know, the underground tunnels and who knows what might happen there and the kind of unknowability of the language and the customs, and even the food seems to scare a lot of NYPD officers who, you know, traverse through Chinatown. Even then, detectives are saying that that Chinatown does not pose nearly the same moral threat as the Black and Tan, which are these saloons where supposedly Black and white people can socialize. So even as kind of mysterious and almost like mystical as the NYPD make Chinatown and crime in Chinatown sound, it is still ranked as not quite as much of a moral threat to upstanding white society as Black Leisure and Black Vice districts. And so all of these things kind of, like I said, they happen in context with one another. But you're absolutely right that there's a kind of Orientalism and an unknowability about, you know, mysterious Chinatowns and Chinese people that still comes up in rhetoric about, especially about Chinese crime and about nowadays a lot of like Chinese espionage, like thinking about Chinatowns as being hotbeds for like some kind of loyalty to Chinese nationalism or something. And whenever there is a story that emerges about, you know, Chinese espionage in the United States, a lot of this rhetoric sounds very historical, and the way they couch the unknowability of what happens in Chinatown.
And since you go through such a long history, there were periods of reform and retrenchment. Particularly in hiring people from the communities that were being policed and then restricting the hiring from those communities. But what reforms do you think were most important, and what reforms do you think can give us a roadmap for how to improve policing?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's so interesting to look at such a kind of long scale, a large scope of history, because you see that one, reforms instituted by the upper administrators of a police department have a really hard time penetrating the rank and file. And we see this to this day. I mean, you know, how many police departments have banned chokeholds, and yet you still see chokeholds all the time, and, you know, various videos taken of encounters with police. It's very hard for the priorities of the kind of political appointees at the top and the reformers at the top to penetrate people who, you know, are subject to a lot of inertia. People don't want to change the way they police. And part of trying to find, and I think the failure of a lot of police reforms have been really obstructed by this inertia. The other thing that's interesting is you when you look at policing at this large of a scope, you see reforms last long enough to become the problem. And then they have to, like, you know, introducing police cars is a way of getting police off the street so they're not randomly beating people up. And then suddenly the cars become the obstruction to police getting to know a neighborhood. So the reform is getting them out of the cars, even though the cars in some ways were an original reform. Or as you alluded to, recruiting people in a neighborhood led to the idea that, you know, that police on the ground would show favoritism to the people they knew, that they were more apt to develop regimes of corruption and bribery because they knew the people there. So the reform was recruiting people from outside of those neighborhoods. And then the accusation was that those police didn't have a connection to the neighborhoods, that they were able to bring in, you know, stereotypes and biases because they were coming from outside. So the reform was recruiting people from inside those neighborhoods. So, you know, almost all these reforms live long enough to become problems that then you have to reform against again. So I think, you know, looking at policing at such a long scale shows that reforms, rather than taking away responsibilities of the police and giving them to other civic institutions, is I think reforms is less the right way to look at it, especially when you look at this history, because you know, I think, you know, even things like police body cams, like depending on who controls the footage, is similar to, you know, having a partner there, and the partner can observe the police officer and can theoretically testify against them. But if police control the information on a body cam, just as they maintain secrecy when they are physically watching other officers, it still doesn't do much good for accountability. So I think looking at a larger scope of the history of policing kind of shows that in some ways the institution itself is too subject to inertia to be reformed, and that kind of chipping away at some of the responsibilities and some of the encounters, the daily encounters people have with officers, is, I think, one of the ways to go forward in terms of trying to curb some police brutality.
All right. We are just about out of time. Any other questions, Mike, Mary? All right. Thank you, Dr. Guariglia. We appreciate your time. And hopefully the attendees will pick up a copy of your book.
Please do. Out wherever books are sold.
The Duke University Press, Police in the Empire City, Race and the Origins of Modern Policing in New York.
Thank you all for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks.
Thank you. This was fantastic. Thank you all for your great questions and for discussing the book and for all your great work, honestly.
Thank you. Thank you. And the best to you. Happy holidays.
You too.
Thanks.
Keep in touch.